Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's October 10th, 2021, and welcome to episode 243 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, wireless connections, networking, and other things. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hey there, Paul. I'm doing good. How about you?
Excellent. I'm sort of scatterbrained, I think, like last time we recorded, but everything's good. You know, it's not quite winter yet, not summer anymore. Also joining us is Ian Baranofsky from Austin, Texas. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Ian, you're going to have to carry us today because
we're both really.
Neither Paul nor I seem to be particularly coherent.
That's true. <right. laughs> However, the error I just made was cut out.
Yes. the wonders of post-production.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently I can't multitask like I used to, but, anyway, so today I think we're going to continue talking a little bit about retro networking. We talked about that last time, and Ian and I were both on that last one, but Earl was not. So we'll maybe start with Earl's thought on just, you know, the retro networking and however you want to think about it, whether it's at the time or currently with retro things or whatever seems appropriate.
When I hear the phrase retro networking, and I know there was some conversation about that on the last show, what exactly does it mean? What initially popped into my head was local area networking from my corporate days. So this would have been mid to late 80s into the early 90s, just before TCP/IP and internet-style networking started to take over. There was proprietary networking, and we used that. Before we had networking, we had the mainframes and we had what we called data lines. These are memories from my aerospace days when I worked at Hughes Aircraft. Our PCs were connected to the mainframe with these incredibly expensive cards. The first ones we had were called Forte cards and then Irma cards, but what they boiled down to was an IBM terminal implemented on a PC card. So you'd plug it in, you'd run some specific software, which would make your PC look like a 3270-esque terminal. And you could upload files to the mainframe or download them and then put them into DBase or Lotus or whatever you wanted to do. It was interesting. I guess it was networking and that you were communicating with another system, but it wasn't local area networking. It wasn't like a peer networking. It was more like hub and spoke. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we had that I thought was really interesting, we had a telephone system that incorporated, they called them data phones. They had a DB25 on the back, which was effectively a 9600 baud modem that would let you connect to other locations within our company over, 9600 baud was pretty smoking then for communications. So
for a short period of time.
For a tiny period of time, but this was when modems on the street were significantly slower than that. So we were doing pretty good in terms of corporate communications. Still not local area networking, more point-to-point circuit switch networking, but fast, and we could connect to some of our systems like our DEC VAXs and other mainframes and other systems. Anyway, that was really interesting. But one day, a colleague of mine, who was particularly good at sensing industry trends, taps me on the shoulder and he says, "Hey, I want to show you the future." And with this particular colleague, when he said something like that, you wanted to listen because he probably was about to show you the future. So we went back to the PC lab and he showed me this box full of red books that said Novell on them. And he said, "This is where everything is going." And I thought, "What is it?" He explained to me kind of the concept of a local area network. And we took the books and the disks out and started doing our first installation of Novell NetWare version 2. I don't remember what it was, maybe 2.1. It was kind of awful to install, actually. You had to get the configuration settings right and then do some sort of a compilation step that is reminiscent of the bad old days of the Linux kernel when you had to configure the Linux kernel and tell it specifically what hardware you had and then recompile it to get it to use that hardware. So not easy to configure, not easy to use, but we got it up and running. And we got a few systems up on the network, which was really pretty exciting. Then we could share hard drive volumes. We could begin to share printers. And it took the PCs from the world of being either a leaf node on something like a mainframe network to being a peer-to-peer communication system. And that was phenomenal. That was really fun. The networking mechanism for those things was primitive, to say the least. The Ethernet cards that we put into the PCs, and this is PCXTs, or in a handful of cases, ATs, and maybe even a 386 if you were super lucky, but ISOBUS kind of stuff. So we would take the Ethernet cards and put them in, and they were coaxial-based. We had these coax runs that, in some cases, went up through the fault ceiling and over into the other room. You weren't supposed to do that, but people did. And you would have three or four computers connected on this coax daisy chain, and then that would connect up into the... Our Ethernet stuff was DEC equipment at that point. I don't remember exactly why. I think we had some big deal with DEC on their equipment. So if somebody would come along and unplug this coaxial run from their computer, they were basically unplugging it from all the computers.
Right.
They would break the line and break everything, and then you'd be running around trying to figure out, why can't so-and-so get on the network? And it wasn't particularly reliable either. If the coax would get frayed or somebody forgot to put a terminator on the very end, then things were bad. And all of that didn't matter because it was so exciting to be able to take these individual PCs that had been islands up to that point and share resources with them and actually get people sharing files with each other and getting the files backed up to backup systems that, you know, we eventually put in a backup tape units on the Novell server. Where are some of the other things? Oh, we had the typical IRQ and DMA fights that you had with PCs back then where you had to figure out, because now we were introducing yet another card into the PC. There were already several that were taking out. So we tried to standardize and we failed at standardizing what the IRQ should be and that. And so inevitably somebody would put another card in their PC and everything would go south and we'd have to go fix it up. And still, I have to say, it was really interesting and exciting times. Eventually, it came to the point where you had applications, database applications, that could do record-level locking over the network. So you could access a central file, and everyone could be accessing the same data with a multi-user application in a really bad way, because file-level multi-user access was, I think, dicey at best and catastrophic at worst, but it worked most of the time. I'm trying to think that the next major step after this was when we went to NetWare version 3, because this was the version where you went from that old style that you had to get all the configuration right and compile it and make sure everything was perfect to having what they called NetWare loadable modules. This was kind of like the equivalent of Linux kernel modules, dynamic modules that can load in and out. So no longer did you have to recompile the whole thing to make it work. You could set up some initialization files, some ini files, and load these modules and dynamically reconfigure your Novell server at will. And that was a very big deal. That helped us out a lot. And the other nice thing about that was with a Novell server, you only ever had what you needed because you explicitly told it what to load. You never had any services running around like you do with Windows and other operating systems that you don't even know what it does. You look at the process tree of a modern Windows or Linux system, half the things on there, you don't know what's going on. Why are you running all this stuff? And with NetWare, you never had that. So we had giant bookshelves of books mm-hmm. like this. And for our listeners, what I'm showing is a red Novell NetWare 3 system administration guide.
And it looks just like everybody knows that sort of iconic yes, image. I mean, it looks just like you think it does.
Yep. And the Novell documentation, at least on version 3, I thought was really well written. So we were able to properly understand what was going on and configure our Novell servers. We called our servers some version of Spam is the name that we gave to them. And this was from the Monty Python, the Spam song. And the funny thing was when we would go to Hughes get-togethers where all the system administrators from the various divisions would show up, we'd say, oh, we're from Division 78. And they would say, you're the Spam dudes. So we got that nickname thanks to our Novell servers. What else did I want to say about that? That might be it. Other than when NetWare went to version 4 and they brought in LDAP and directory services, it started to get really sophisticated. And I think for me, even though that was much more useful and you could do many things that you couldn't previously with a local area network scenario related to people's identities and keeping track of computers and that, still, that's at the point where it lost the magic for me. I thought this is kind of now jumped the shark into a world that is incredibly complex, really prone to getting things wrong, and it kind of was, although, again, directory services were critical, which we found out because then Microsoft adopted a mechanism for directory services called Active Directory. And at that point, I started to see maybe the days of Novell waning. I thought, you know, I think they're not going to make it through this. Up till now, they've had this incredible advantage of having this great directory service, but I think now Microsoft's going to eat their lunch. I actually got to travel to the mothership, the Novell mothership in Utah, in the days when I think their fortune was starting to trail off. And it had the feel of a place that this was a super exciting place to be in. We were on top of the market, and now we're not on top of the market anymore. You could almost see the shadow starting to come over them. Mm-hmm. And when we got NetWare, at that point, then use of things like the mainframe continued, but the PC networking world was really on its way. And from that point, there was no stopping it. I remember also being in a meeting where some of the technical or R&D people in IT were talking about this thing called TCP/IP. And they were saying that we should switch all of our Novell networking to TCP/IP. Which at the time, if you did that, would have been a great step for the future, but it broke all the applications. So I told them, well, we can't switch off of Novell. And what was their, I can't remember what the name of the Novell NetWare protocol was. Wow, I can't believe it. I can't dig up those brain cells. But it wasn't TCP/IP. It was its own routable protocol, but completely its own thing. And these guys were saying, well, you got to switch to TCP/IP because it's the future and everything's going to be the future and you'll be able to network with the whole world. And I told them that would be great, but then it would break all my applications today. So maybe we should wait for the future to get here. I guess in retrospect, it turns out they were kind of right and I was wrong, because it was the future and now everything's on it. But still would have broke all our apps and made all the users fire me. So I guess I'm glad I didn't do that. Little before its time. Those are my memories from networking. And they're primarily corporate, because the, you know, at home, I mean, your networking was a modem, right? If you had anything at all, people really didn't have LANs that they were building at home, I don't think. I could be wrong.
You'd have to have multiple computers for that.
Right.
The chat has overwhelmingly told us that IPX or SPX is the
IPX
protocol.
Thank you. Wow, I can't believe I forgot that. Too many gray hairs. Thank you, chat.
Yeah, you mentioned actually that this is was sort of a move from the computers being like a little island to like being interconnected, and it's funny how you know, like being connected has just become part of like the way we think about things now, that it is, you know, it's almost a little weird to turn on an Apple II or something and, you know, like it's just, there's no connection to the outside world. It's just like what you've got there and maybe something on a disk you're holding in your hand, you know.
Well, the way to share data we called SneakerNet,
right?
Because you would take your floppy and you'd walk it down the hall and you'd give it to somebody else, which had its own problems. One time, my friend had spent a lot of time working on a spreadsheet, and he gave it to the guy in production control to take to the lab that they had. And the guy took the 5 1/4 floppy, no lie, folded it up in quarters and stuck it in his pocket and walked off.
Cool.
Now, my friend had a backup, of course, because we were very careful. But he was kind of like, wait, you can't do that. So when we were able to actually share the file from our workstation to the production control system, that was really, boy, I tell you, that was uptown.
So Ian, I think last time we determined that you didn't do a lot of networking amongst your retro computers, but do you have any thoughts on the networking topic that we didn't cover last time?
Well, it's certainly not my area of expertise, and I still haven't really successfully gotten online or networked computers between each other. So not so much to add.
Did you do like PBSing and stuff back in the actual day?
Absolutely. I soon after my 13th birthday, when I got a Hayes Micromodem 2E, you know, I was online just checking out the local BBSs, and not long after that, trying to download wares like everybody else. I think the interesting thing about being online with an Apple II in the early 80s was it was a lot of proprietary software. We didn't all use terminal emulators. We used, you know, ASCII Express and direct dial-up to each other, which had some degree of compatibility between different programs, but frequently it would be, you know, what software are you using? I'll use that software, and then we can transfer files to each other. If not, I don't even know. I can barely remember what the protocol was that you would use to dial up a regular BBS. I remember having to fuss with it when it got to the 90s and I had a PC. Well, it was probably the late 80s and I had a PC. But, you know, we would be worried about X modem and Z modem and file transfer protocols. But on the Apple II, I remember a couple of mostly transfer programs, like how you would pirate, you know, over the phone line. But I remember, I don't know if I made it up, but I think it was called Disk Fur. I know there was Cat Fur.
Yep, you didn't make it up.
You
did not, no.
Yeah. If you didn't have an Apple Cat, you would use Disk Fur. If you had an Apple Cat and you could go 1200 baud half duplex, you would use Cat Fur. And you could actually, I think the most amazing thing about that was that you could chat at the same time as doing a transfer.
Yeah.
So, you know, what little you had to say to your fellow pirates, you know, you could say at the same time as, you know, downloading the latest copy of Sticky Bear Opposites or whatever it is that you, you senselessly were pirating.
Yeah, that was one of the coolest things about Cat Fur. I used that a fair amount too. That it, you know, it's because it was a half duplex thing. It would basically send the block and then switch down to 300 baud to say, like, everything okay? And then at that point, it would just, you know, transfer the chat messages, and then it would go back to send, you know, half duplex to send the next block. And, it was just a single guy's program, you know. Ubiquitous Hacker was the guy's name. I have the source code somewhere to that, in fact. But anyway, yeah, that was a program that I spent a lot of time with. Actually, I did in my early days, I did some mods for it. So I actually had written a little thing that would, it was sort of like Eliza. You could chat back and forth. So, you know, you didn't have to actually be talking to a person. They would just use that chat window to like converse with you robotically.
The inevitable question is why? Why did you need a robot to talk to?
Because you could, you know, because it was cool.
Yeah.
I think I developed all these things so that I could put them on a BBS that I then never really launched. But, you know, it was fun to write them.
That's amazing.
I did remember another funny story now that somebody reminded me IPX was the protocol, which is hilarious because I used to work at a company that made routers and switches and did protocol things like IPX and IP. And anyway, just the funny story was that we went to a Windows NT training class. And it was back in the day when you would actually go to a physical class and go do something, learn something. All of the computers were set up with IPX, even though it was a Windows NT class. And so somebody, I don't remember who it was, brought in Descent. And this was one of the first multiplayer games that I ever had the opportunity to. I just loved it. And so during lunch and breaks, all of us were playing Descent, and it Descent actually supported IPX as a networking mechanism. So we could load up the ODI drivers on the computer and get IPX running, and then all of us were playing against each other on Descent, and that was super fun. I don't remember what other games might have supported that. I don't know that I ever cared because I just did such a deep dive on Descent. I didn't really care there was anything else out there in the universe.
Mm-hmm. I get it. Yeah, I tried that. I think I tried that once, networking with a friend of mine, but that I was never very good at handling all three dimensions. I mean, like the trick with Descent is that the thing can move in all three directions and all three dimensions, that is. And it was really quite difficult. So the friend I was playing with, you know, he was very good at it, and I was, immediately doomed. By the way, Doom also did IPX, according to Mark in the chat.
6 degrees of freedom was one of the real innovations of Descent, and you did have to get used to it. You had to get used to sliding, too, going horizontally left and right, but sliding your ship as opposed to pointing it and then going in a direction. If you didn't get good at that, you were going to die really quickly when you started to face some of the bosses in the higher levels.
Strafing is what we call it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. In like Doom type games or whatever. What was it called? There was Descent, there was Descent 2, and then there was a later one.
There's Descent 3, and then there was Overload, I think, was some of the that which was fairly recent. Some of the folks who had worked on the original Descent did a fundraiser, which I was a contributor to. And they came up with a super fun game, which is very reminiscent of Descent, but with modern graphics, it's gorgeous.
There was, who is it? So Parallax was the software company that was responsible for the original one. This friend of mine who easily killed me when we were trying to play Network Descent, went to work for, I think, Volition, who was working on some sort of subsequent Descent universe game. It was much more sophisticated, but I don't quite remember. Anyway, cool. I don't feel too bad about, you know, losing so badly to the guy who later went to work for the company. So, let's see. Did I have any network things I wanted to say? I'm still working on trying to get my own sort of like setup here. And I, you know, to the extent that any of my computers can talk to each other, I've you know, been attempting to make that work. But most of the things I have here are Apple things. So I guess this is sort of like contemporary use of retro networking. But I was saying last time that getting these things onto the real internet is almost useless because nobody speaks the internet speaks a much more highly encrypted language than any of these things can understand. So what I've been hoping to do is like whatever, to the extent that any of them can do Wi-Fi, I'm going to try to broadcast Wi-Fi from my iMac G4 to the other ones, but just basically still contain everything inside the house, except for the oldest ones, like the Apple II. I have an Ethernet card for that. It's like an Ethernet connection. I think that one I might actually connect to the real internet because nobody's going to try to talk to it. So if there's not like no damage can be done by doing that. So,
or at least the damage is contained.
That's right. Yeah. But anyway, it's definitely been interesting trying to figure out like how to route everything and how to get everything to talk to everything and getting Netatalk running on. I've got a router and a switcher just for like my retro network. I'm about halfway done with it, and so I feel like I've been doing a lot of networking things, but I don't have anything sort of interesting to say about it beyond that. So more soon, I guess.
Is Netatalk still developed, still supported, or are you using a really old version of it? Paul, did we lose you?
Speaking of networking, it seems...
Paul, I think we might have lost you.
It's apropos that we have a networking issue. Of course, my first thought is I have a networking issue. I lost Paul, but I think Paul lost us.
Because I think Paul was probably just about to do the feedback section.
We had under the listener feedback, we do have a mention of a Sam Coupe spotting in the wild, which I'm still not certain it exists. It was a link from Twitter user Binary Dinosaurs, which is at Binary Dinosaurs, has a photo of their Sam Coupe, which is spelled capital S-A-M, and then, you know, coupe. So I think that's a fascinating but probably fake photo.
It's too bad Carrington's not here to fact check it.
I think what needs to be done is we need to make sure that user has more than one post over a number of years and try to authenticate the user, because I think it's the Sam Coupe conspiracy all over again. I've really fallen into the Carrington camp where, it seems like this is the mythical computer. Do you believe in the Sam Coupe, Earl?
I think I'm agnostic on the Sam Coupe so far. I haven't really thrown in with one camp or the other on that yet. I've never seen one in person. I'll just put it that way.
I mean, a car-shaped computer. I don't think so.
I remember the other big networking protocol back then, Paul reminded me, with his Netatalk, was AppleTalk and then EtherTalk. We did a lot of that in the early 90s. When I moved up here to Oregon from LA, I worked for a company that had standardized on Macintosh. And from a corporate perspective, that was kind of rare. So rather than focusing on the networking protocols that you'd use for a bunch of PCs, they had focused on AppleTalk and EtherTalk, and they really had it down. They had it down pat. And then they switched to PCs later, but learned a bunch about AppleTalk and EtherTalk then.
I never have messed with networking protocols. If I can't just plug it in or click to connect, it's to me, it's every time it's relearning it, every time I have to troubleshoot it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I live in blissful ignorance of AppleTalk and other, more complex networking protocols.
I think that's kind of the ideal state from the user perspective. You should just be able to plug something in and have it work. And if it doesn't, which it didn't a lot in the early days, then that was kind of rough on everybody. But AppleTalk was very user-friendly. You could most of the time just plug in and have it work.
Actually, my first experience with networking and one of my first experiences with computers was my high school. They must have had a donation, but it was I think they had a VAX mainframe with, you know, a dozen or maybe 16 terminals. And it was the first time I would ever chat, or, you know, we obviously were time sharing. I'm not even sure if that seems to be the old school term for networking, but we would share the resources of the computer, and it all seemed, you know, like pure magic, as though we each had our own individual computer that we were networked to through these terminals. But breaking in and chatting was a pretty amazing experience in, you know, 1981, you know, for those of us who hadn't had exposure to some of the more sophisticated networked systems, you know, in the past, like Plato, you know. But it's interesting because networking has really touched all of our lives, and now it's obviously to the extreme we're all permanently networked. But I think people take very seriously what they, you know, what is communicated on a network. And we did at the time, too. I think that I really felt a connection to people who I was just typing at 300 baud with. You know, it was crazy. It was definitely different.
Have you ever seen the BBS documentary?
Jason Scott's documentary?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I love that. That showed not just how the technology evolved, but how the relationships between people would go along with the technology. In some cases, they would have get-togethers. I mean, people formed relationships. People got married. There was drama. There's all kinds of things. It was very real for people.
Absolutely. Well, another digression is I remember as soon as I got my modem, I was willing to dial anything local, you know, and local at the time meant it didn't have a toll charge, because you could be in the same area code and, oh, there's Paul, and you could still be charged to call, you know, to make a phone call to your friend who was 10 miles away. It was pretty crazy. But I remember I would call dating websites. No, not websites, excuse me, dating BBSs. And I'm sure with some research we could figure out some of the names of the standard dating. There was dating BBSs all over the country in 1983. It was pretty crazy. I mean, I was a 14-year-old kid, so to me it was kind of exciting, but I didn't really think I was going to find myself a date. It wasn't even feasible, but it was just like anything I could dial, I would dial, and everything was almost equally fascinating.
It was pretty interesting about the local toll. People don't really think about that or remember that from back in the day, but the phone companies just must have been making money hand over fist, because depending on how the lines were drawn, you could call somebody that wasn't really that far away and still wind up paying a permanent charge. It's just absolutely insane. Hey, Paul, can you hear us? Welcome back.
Well, Earl and I had a fine chat to entertain our YouTube viewers, and
excellent.
Maybe you'll find it entertaining enough to include in the podcast. But
I'm sure I will. Anyway, I think I was, for a while, I remembered what I was saying, and then by now I've forgotten, but that's okay. It was just me talking about my setting up the network, I think. So, oh yes, NetAtalk. You were asking about NetAtalk, and I was about to tell you, maybe so, if I start telling you about the current development status of NetAtalk, perhaps I will all get a new kernel panic, because, you know, big NetAtalk is after me. But they are still developing it, and there are new versions and things, but as of, I think, now I forget, somewhere at the end of the 2 series, they stopped supporting the old networking that the Macs relied on, you know, in the classic era. So you can install it, but it won't help you for the things we want to do with it. So I actually had to compile, I think it was 2.16 or something like that. There's some older version. I had to kind of like compile myself rather than just sort of apt-get install.
So just one more funny story. We were going to add the AppleTalk EtherTalk protocol to the routers at the router company that I worked at. I was in the QA department. So I went out and I bought Apple's excellent book describing the Apple Talk protocol and read it from cover to cover and got ready with my QA test plan for when the engineers released the version of the router that would support it. So they released the version, and 10 minutes later, I went walking down to the engineering area, and they looked at me aghast, like, how could you possibly have found a bug already? And they were kind of angry that I was there that fast, actually. But I said to them, do you guys know that zone names in Apple Talk are case sensitive? And they just stood there looking at me with a blank stare. And I said, well, they are, and I just broke your software, so you might want to go back to the drawing board, because some of the other systems that they worked with weren't case sensitive in terms of the naming convention, but Apple Talk was. I just remember that the engineers really didn't like me as much after that, but but we saw that. I mean, not that I would hope that a corporation setting up Apple networking wouldn't name two things the same with just a difference in the upper lower case. That seems like a bad idea to do, even if it works. But anyway, another little funny story. And I'm done now. So no more funny stories, I promise. Not till the next podcast.
Okay. Phew. yeah, so there has been a little bit of feedback, but not a lot, actually. So, I mean, there's still a fair amount of pending feedback that I haven't gone back to. But one thing that we were sent, it was a Sam Coupe spotted in the wild.
We were talking about that when you were off on your blue screen.
Uh-huh.
So question for you, are you a believer?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I have faith in the Sam Coupe. In fact, actually, there is there's an eBay auction, too. It's the first time I've actually seen one on eBay, though, of course, they must have appeared on eBay before. But if you want, I think, where is it? It is in Belgium. And if you want ultra rare MGT Sam Coupe boxed with manuals for just under 2,000 euros, you can place a bid. The one that's in the auction actually does look pretty nice, but I mean, it's also pretty expensive.
Well, we only have ourselves to thank for promoting the Sam Coupe cause.
That's right. yeah, it is funny. I mean, like this has become a bit of a, you know, recurring thing on the podcast, but I mean, like I had not heard of it, you know, 6 months ago or whatever. I mean, like somehow it was a computer that had completely gone by me. So
likewise, and that's why it just seems like a fiction. Although this seems like a real box. It's harder to fake a box.
You think? But yeah, it would be, I guess it'd be a funny art project, right? Make up an 80s computer and then
absolutely.
Try to convince people, like experts on a podcast. Anyway, who sent us that? I think, won't I? Yes, Chuck on Facebook pointed out the Sam Coupe spotted in the wild. So thank you, Chuck, from Facebook. I think we can probably just move on to our items of interest. And Earl, you have the first of these.
Oh, do I? Is it the one about the cave?
It is.
So Neil with RMC The Cave is building a computer museum in the UK. And the geography is a little confounding to me. I don't exactly understand it. It's in Chalford, which is in Stroud, and has something to do with Gloucestershire. And so I don't know exactly on a map where that is, but it's a real place. Unlike the Sam Coupe, I think this one's real. Uh-huh. And the museum that he's building it looks great and has lots of stations for people to come in and play with old technology. One of the things that I found interesting about what he's building is this reproduction of a computer software / game shop. So you can walk in and there are boxed software. You can't buy them, but they're boxed on the shelf like in the old days when you would walk into something like an Egghead or a Software Etc. or maybe a Radio Shack store, something like that, although I think that was A little less common for software, but they're shrink wrapping these boxes. They're putting them on the shelf. They have a little kiosk where you can walk up and play the old games. And for just a moment, you can pretend that you're in an old software store. And it got me to thinking, you know, that's one aspect of computing from the 80s and the 90s, was going to the store and actually buying a boxed piece of software. It was exciting to go there and see what was new, because oftentimes seeing it on the shelf might be the first time that you were aware of something that had come out. And it got me, you know, I got to being a little meta and wondering, what other aspects do people miss of computing from the 80s and 90s? Was it just using the computers themselves, or was it going to the computer store? Was it going to user groups, or was it looking at magazines? You're actually showing magazines now, which is one of the things that they have at the Cave. So I was wondering for both of you, what aspects of it do you wax nostalgic for from the actual physical computer experience in the 80s and 90s? Did you enjoy going to the computer store?
Well, it was always sort of an excursion, like a special excursion for me. Because it was, you know, things were sort of spread out, and so it required driving, and I couldn't drive. And so, but actually, even when I could, it was sort of a specific thing to go out to the computer store. So I didn't go that often. I didn't really hang out there. You know, I would go look around in Radio Shack occasionally, because that was local to me. But I don't actually have a lot of computer store memories, surprisingly, even though I know that people do, but I'm just not among them, I guess. I don't know, Ian, did you do much hanging out in computer stores?
Well, I mean, not hanging out per se, because I know that computer stores and software stores often had a few regulars that were there for the long haul. It was an event for them. They'd go and they'd stay there for a few hours. And I think there's lots of interesting tales of people kind of getting their start in a computer store that they couldn't afford a computer, and the first time that they really programmed or enjoyed it was at a computer store. But oh yeah, I loved going to the computer store. I loved going to the store, you know, at the mall. And at one point, you know, the booksellers got into software, and that's where I believe Software Etc. came from. Maybe it started independently, but I loved going between all of the shops and checking out everything that they had. And you would commonly buy a $30 piece of software, based on the packaging alone, the artwork, the packaging, and the screenshots, even if they were from another platform that you didn't have. But it is a memory that rings strong with me, and I'm sure a lot of our viewers, because in the 80s and 90s, that was your main option if you weren't pirating everything. And I think there was a point after Apple II where I would just buy what I wanted to play instead of trying to get a copy of it or something. Sometimes we would, you know, try to copy a code wheel, but for the most part, I felt even at that time when I didn't have much money, I still felt good about supporting developers for games I knew were going to give me hours and hours of enjoyment, in role-playing games and other high-quality games of the time. But going to the store was a huge part of that experience. And computer stores in general, just when you had to buy a new computer, it was always super exciting to go in and see the latest tech and everything looking glossy and all of the trim levels that you couldn't afford. And this store display created by Neil is just one aspect of this Cave project that he has going on. And I'm always incredibly impressed at the level of care and detail that's put into his projects. It sets a standard that just seems difficult to meet by, you know, anybody else. It's just incredible. He prints signs. He finds the shelving. He, you know, it's it's things that seem feasible, but definitely a real time sink to make it perfect. If you've ever watched any of his videos about refurbishing or repairing computers, they'll frequently go way beyond just making sure it functions and making sure it looks good, and even retrobriting. They replace badges and reprint all kinds of things. It's amazing. This guy does incredible work. And I also would note that I'm equally dumbfounded by the location of this of him and his cave in England. I thought I knew England a little bit for an American, but clearly I don't know most of these areas at all. But I would love to visit.
Well, Matt in the chat mentioned that Stroud is in the southwest of the UK, and I completely agree about the work that Neil and the folks who help him out with do for the cave and for his restoration videos. It is just immaculate. So it actually makes me want to go to the UK just to visit when they're done and be able to see what they've come up with. And I was curious about your experience in computer stores. I don't really have the same perspective because I started my computer career in computer retail between 1980 and 83. Mm-hmm. So being a person who worked at the computer store is a little bit different vantage point than the people who would actually come to the computer store to buy things. It's a different level of experience, I think. And I can absolutely verify that there were regulars who would come to the computer store and stay there for many hours playing the video games or playing the computer, you know, programming the computers and that kind of thing. And that was fine. That never was a problem in my experience. It might have been with some folks in some stores, but it was just kind of neat having some people who would stop by and do those things. And often they would buy things too. So at least there was a little financial reward for the wear and tear that they were putting on the merchandise.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because like he's going to this great care to sort of reproduce a sort of period computer store. And yet I bet that same care was not really put into it by the people in the period who made the computer store in the first place, right? I mean, they just sort of threw some stuff onto the shelves. And
it depended. I worked in three different chains of computer retail. And I would say that the three had vastly different amounts of attention to detail in terms of the merchandising. And the last computer store that I worked for, called HW Computers, had an absolutely beautiful layout. We had these Native American tapestries on the wall, and the furniture, the cubicle areas that we had set up were, was it O'Sullivan furniture? That was the name of the computer furniture from back in the day, right? We had some of their nice workstations, and we had computers that were on display. We always made sure that they were working and that the shelves were nicely merchandised. So I think it just depended on which store you went into. The last one I worked at, we actually did put quite a bit of care into that.
In the chat, Mark mentions that his Apple dealer was Team Electronics, and that also mine. I remember that that there was a Team Electronics at a mall not far away. That would be the place I went to, and that's like the receipts that I still have for the family computer say Team Electronics on them. And I think they actually just went out of business not very long ago, like a year or two ago. It was a very long lasting company. Before there were Apple stores, there was that. Mr. Allen in the chat also said that Computerland had computers set up in different corners that looked like a home office or a kid's bedroom, you know, sort of showing it set up as if it were actually like in use. Anyway, thanks. I guess, Ian, you have the next thing.
Yeah, I thought I'd bring up the MCE to VGA converter. It's a device that's not a trivially inexpensive device, but certainly not expensive. And I think these devices popped up a couple years ago as people started using these inexpensive and pretty fast processors to do a lot of the heavy lifting on video formats. But this converts your kind of classic IBM PC 5150 era CGA, MCGA monochrome to a VGA output. And I think it even has some settings to make it have a more authentic video output, you know, related to scan line emulation and interlacing. These are great devices. It's good to have them handy if you have very many computers, you know, coming in and out of your workshop, because, you know, before 1986, it was common that you would run into these, but the monitors are a little bit light on the ground. You can find them if you want to, and some of our listeners almost certainly have one or several of them, but I find that they're not that easy to get, and keeping them around is really for those who want to keep a PC sitting on their desk. They look good, but more commonly you'll probably have a VGA monitor handy, whether it's an LCD or a wonderful CRT. And these devices are great to have around. This is the MC to VGA at CertaShop, which is a website that has a ton of really interesting vintage computing related gadgets. They are the one of the websites that sells the sound cards that fit in parallel ports of old PC compatibles. They have sound cards that are AdLib compatible or Tandy Sound compatible. They have a ton of other stuff, but I find it all to be super useful to have around. And and I have a similar device to this CGE to VGA, and I use it for my Tandy 1000, and it's great to have around for computers of that era.
Yeah, that's cool. I feel like I don't know this era stuff that well. I have, but I do remember coming across some information at some point that like you could easily kill your monitor if you plugged like the wrong one into the wrong card. You know, like I forget now what it is that can kill your monitor, but something can. You know, like if I plug the CGA monitor into an EGA card or vice versa. So I've always been a little bit scared of that, but I do, you know, I have exactly one, you know, PC with a card and a monitor. And if any component of that dies, I don't know what I'd do. So it's good to have this option.
I don't know if we've talked about this particular vendor on the podcast before, have we? It doesn't sound familiar to me. The stuff they sell sounds cool.
Yeah. I mean, everything's listed in euros, so it's, you know, presumably is not in North America. I don't know where it is.
Yeah, they are. You are importing stuff when you buy from this company. Although, I'm not an authority on the offerings in the U.S., but I find that the European companies have more offerings, and there's a few more companies that are providing for our vintage computing needs. I love to support U.S. sellers, and if only because of shipping. But I also wouldn't hesitate to buy from a big, reliable company like this. I think for me, I keep thinking of Certa as more than anything, they tend to be the first to bring a lot of these new developments to market, like that parallel to AdLib or Sound Blaster type of devices. But I think they also have promised, they also can sometimes be slow. They may sell out of things and it may take them a while to restock. And I think that's pretty typical for all of these retro computing hardware vendors, whether it's the time it takes to build the hardware or the lead time it takes to order it and the amount of money that they have to put out just to put in an order to China of, you know, 50 pieces or 100 pieces. So it's, a challenging market to be in. So I'm willing to forgive the expansive euro price and the shipping for, you know, items that I really need and sometimes, you know, can build to save money or just buy completely built, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is neat to see a new store that we weren't aware of, just to see what things are out there. And I think I know that there are some things, if there turns out to be enough demand, there are some things that people in the U.S. have sort of like bulk ordered and to redistribute. Like I know CT6502, Chris Torrance's site, will do that for the booty card out of Australia, which is super helpful, you know, because individually shipping them off from Australia is expensive and there's enough demand here to just you know, have this, you know, North American distribution.
And not just the shipping costs, but the time to get it delivered.
Okay, let's see. My thing, I don't actually know a huge amount about this, but so I came across this project. It's for the TI-99/4A called the Strange Cart. And so this is Eric Peel who's doing this. And so what it basically is a little card that goes in the cartridge slot. And it's you know, serves as a coprocessor. And it doesn't, as far as I can tell, it's not natively used by the 99/4A for anything. So you have to write software that knows it's there and can deal with it. He's written also a version of the basic interpreter that offloads the compilation or the instructions to this thing. That's how I came across this at first. Actually, was that I had seen one of his videos about about sort of running BASIC, and the TI-99/4A is sort of famously slow. It's a 16-bit computer or whatever, but it's but there's something about the, I forget exactly what the problem was. It's something like the BASIC is doubly interpreted or something like that. There's something that really makes it quite slow. And so that was one of Eric's projects, was to make, you know, to make a version of BASIC that would just fly. And I mean, so it's an interesting project. Beyond what I just said, I don't know a whole lot about it. It is kind of cool to see, you know, things that you can use in your old actual hardware to run sort of like modern speed stuff. So this thing that's on the screen is actually like a, you know, sort of mathematical graph animated on the 99/4A screen, which is the kind of thing you could not imagine an actual 99/4A unaided doing. And have either of you seen this before or know anything about the project?
Not me.
I'm going to step away for 1 second.
Okay. Perhaps he's going to get one of these things.
And this is why I stepped away. So an example of something crazy on the TI-99 is, this is the TI-99 version of Dragon's Lair.
Interesting.
Laser disc game that was released in the 80s, and it's all video. And this project reminds me of this cartridge. It was released as a regular size cartridge. Pretty amazing feat. Have we discussed this on the roundtable before?
I do not think so. Feel free to go ahead and talk about it.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when you talk about adding capabilities to retro computers, there's hardly two camps, but there's devices that are sort of vintage ready speed up devices that might use a faster version of a processor. And then there's modern devices that use a Pi or another, modern processor or chip that is just a computer that's a million times more powerful than the actual computer that it's being interfaced with. And I really appreciate a project that more takes advantage of an old platform than just adds, you know, the megaflops through the cartridge port or an expansion port. I mean, where do you draw the line? When is the TI-99 no longer a TI-99? And I'm all for any project involving old computers, although I will get much more excited about things like Dragon's Lair. As I understand it, Dragon's Lair, rather than taking the processing duties away from the TI-99, it just feeds the TI-99 data at an incredibly fast rate. So it actually streams video. Granted, it's a sort of small box of video that is, you know, down-resed for the sake of a TI-99. But this Dragon's Lair just plays incredibly well and true to the original arcade game. So as much as I can't explain it in greater technical depth, as I understand it, it's not just plugging in a computer that's, you know, using the TI for video and sound. It's actually really pushing the TI to its absolute limit as to what it can do. And I love a project like that. So much as I don't know too much about the TI project you're mentioning, you know, and perhaps it actually uses the TI's archaic and unique mainframe style CPU to its greatest extent. I'm also curious as to, you know, truly how this is going to be utilized by hobbyists and how much uptake it will have. So,
is that cartridge that you showed a modern thing?
This absolutely. This came out in the last couple of years, and this is you know, was just like a nice boxed version of this game Dragon's Lair that had a very limited run. I think they sold 100 or something cartridges, a couple hundred cartridges or something. I think that they actually had licensed, or not licensed, but received permission to release this, and only could release it up to a certain date, at which point they had to cease production and distribution. So they certainly sold out of what they had had permission to produce. But it is it probably has a copyright date, but it is, I think, from 2019. So yeah, it's definitely a recent production.
Well, they did a nice enough job on the packaging where I couldn't tell whether or not that was an old school cartridge or if it was something new. It looks really cool.
Yeah. I'm always impressed at people who go through the trouble of making good packaging. I remember in the past, even more so, you could find an engineer or a software engineer or a programmer or hobbyist that could write a program, but then it was always a major step to have that person, you know, distribute it on a cartridge. Well, then there's the next step of creating packaging and artwork and printing, and it's a lot of work. I mean, it's an enormous amount of work, especially if you haven't done it before. And this isn't a publisher that puts out a ton of games or other programs. So you know that there was some real time put into, and real time and real passion put into this kind of a project. And I just love to see it. And I hope I get to see, you know, other ways that people push the limits of the technology. Although again, with it, keeping in mind how much is the actual technology and how much is the computer that you just plugged into it.
Right. Yeah. It's, I suppose there's a sense where this is, it's probably not quite accurate, but I mean, like, if you're just playing, you know, a Blu-ray through an old monitor, you know, then what have you done? But Jeremy in the comments mentions that this sounds a little bit similar, the video, to what Chris Kenoy was doing with the Apple II with streaming video. And that was sort of interesting technically. I think we may have talked about that already, but essentially it was, you know, how you unroll a loop to speed things up. It was sort of unrolling the entire video, just making it a very, very large program that just ran, rather than actually like sort of like having a video decoding frames or whatever. It's just code. But I mean, you know, if you can feed it that information fast enough, then that'll work. And we saw something I don't quite remember, but I know we've talked a little bit about, you know, streaming video on TRS-80s as well. So the TRS vid, this is a YouTube video from 2017. That's a demo of the TRS video player for the Model 1 and 3 computers. And, you know, it looks pretty good for a TRS-80.
Well, they must be doing some kind of crazy glitching because, I mean, the TRS-80 natively, the Model 1, had, you know, no bitmap graphics. It was all character graphics.
Right.
So if it's, you know, if it's smaller than a quarter box of a text character, they're probably doing something interesting. But this might be I believe there's a graphics board at least available for the Model 4.
Right.
I'm not sure if it was available for the Model 3 though. So if they're just doing it on a unmodified TRS-80, that's an incredible accomplishment and probably one that required a lot of thinking.
It says works on stock machines, which only had 128x48 or 160x72 monochrome graphics, which
unbelievable.
So
I think the Model 4 is where it went up to 80 columns, so that would give you, since it's a quarter box, horizontally, that'd give you 160. Model 1 through Model 3, I think, were 64-column machines, which gave them a 128 horizontally.
How are they doing this?
Yeah. It is pretty amazing. It says it's being read off of a enhanced FRED, F-R-E-H-D. And that was I keep forgetting, like I keep not remembering the name of that. Every time we talk about the like the MISE and the M3SE and stuff like that, the FRED is the that's the one I have. I just haven't gotten really into the TRS-80 world quite yet. So.
Yeah, I have a FRED as well, and I've never gotten it working right. And I moved away from it, but I have a couple of TRS-80 projects, you know, waiting in the wings right now, and I probably should try to revisit the FRED. The problem is my FRED is old. I've just been wanting to say my FRED is old, and I find that they make constant improvements to hardware like this. Then just to clarify, FRED is spelled F-R-E-H-D. And it's a type of flash adapter or hard drive emulator through flash media for older TRS-80 computers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great piece of hardware, but mind you, I actually think the difficulty I had was I think you have to do modified ROMs in order to boot from the FRED. So you're going to have to get a disk drive working, and you're going to have the right boot software on a disk. It's not a trivial amount of work to get it working. I think if you are a focused TRS-80 hobbyist, it's not a huge challenge. But for me, every time I move to a new platform, Atari 8-bit, Commodore 64, TRS-80, I have to try to remember how to do anything. They're all just a little bit different.
Yeah. No, it's true that there is, you know, there have been generations of these modern things as well, you know. So I was thinking one of the other things that I was going to mention when we were talking about back on the 99-4A, you know, there was a set of things, the NanoPeb and the CF7 Plus. These are things that you could use like compact flash solutions for the 99-4A. And, you know, like I can't remember. I got a NanoPeb like 6 years ago or something like that. I still haven't quite used it, but you know, like by now, you know, everything I'm sure is SD cards. I don't know what's sort of new in the 99-4A world. It's actually too bad that Blake's not here, because he's our like 99-4A OG, right? But so, Ian, what did you run and grab this time?
I was trying to find, there is, I don't know about easier, but probably it is easier. I was trying to find a TI-99 cartridge. It's a flash adapter, and it's reasonably cheap, and it's an easy build. It's actually a fun build. I built mine, and I took a, you know, home financing or whatever cartridge and you know, plopped it in there. All I had to do is snip out a little space for the compact flash card. But I feel like most TI-99 users or interested people are probably going to be satisfied with an SD card adapter to play most of the cartridge games or programs that they're familiar with. But the NanoPeb is a more extensive kind of hard disk solution. Mm-hmm. That allows you to really upgrade the computer without, you know, using the giant PEB box. So it's a much, I don't know if it's more sophisticated, but I think it's a more sophisticated approach to the problem of getting, you know, software onto your old computer. But I do have a NanoPeb, and it's another thing like the FRED.
Yeah.
it's a solution awaiting time.
Yeah, I noticed when I went to look at the site that there's actually in the more recent years there is now a NanoPeb Wi-Fi adapter as well. So if you want to get your, you know, NanoPeb on the web so it too can realize that everything is encrypted and nothing is readable, then there you go.
And you want to connect to Plato sites.
Oh right, yes. Oh yes, that's right. I forgot we were supposed to talk more about all the like the Fujinet and the Plato stuff. But oh well, there were comments on our previous episode about how, you know, we had a whole discussion of networking and then we didn't talk about Fujinet. We always talk about Fujinet.
Fujinet, another solution awaiting time. I've messed with it a little bit, but I'm almost intimidated by how much it does. I mean, it's sort of it's a tiny device. It does everything. Does it, you know, does it cook? Does it clean? Yes, it does everything. So I wanted to use it as a flash adapter. I would like to try networking with it. I'm a little intimidated, but I'm really looking forward to playing with it. The problem is if I want to use software on the 8-bit through a flash adapter, I mean, I have like three other devices that most of which are already set up to use. So sometimes it's a matter of really deciding you want to go the extra mile to stay modern with your vintage.
Right.
I think Fujinet and things like that are also an interesting case study in the distinction you were making with hooking a super powerful processor to an old computer, and at what point does it become something that feels like cheating or something like that. I actually think the Fujinet is an example of one that I wouldn't feel like I'm cheating. And here's why. It does a lot of stuff. It has an ESP32, probably a dual-core ESP32 processor that is the Wi-Fi processor that runs either at 80 or 160 megahertz. I'm not sure how fast they're running it. But the thing is, it's connecting to the Atari through the SIO port. And the Atari, it's just another SIO type of peripheral with the smarts that protocol has built into it. And the Atari is not really doing anything that the Atari wasn't capable of doing before. It just has a nicer device hanging off of it for networking or for being a virtual disk drive or something like that. So that's one that I don't feel is cheating. But yeah, if you take a Raspberry Pi and connect it up as a coprocessor to a Commodore 64 or something like that, now you've got a computer that is how many orders of magnitude faster, and the Commodore is just being a dumb terminal almost at that point if you do something like that. So I think it depends on the project. With Fujinet, I feel like it's... since it's not doing anything that the computer couldn't do before, it's just being a nicer peripheral. It almost feels like when you upgraded from a 300 baud to a 2400 baud modem, you're still connecting it to your old computer. And people did that back in the day. They upgraded from a 10 megabyte hard drive to a 40 megabyte hard drive. It wasn't cheating.
Someone in the chat mentioned having a Spectranet. I don't actually know the Spectranet. Ethernet for the ZX Spectrum is what it seems to be. A ton of these things to try out. Okay, maybe we can move on to the next thing. More modern hardware for vintage stuff. Ian, you have that.
Oh, yes. Applesauce, the client. So Applesauce is a disk imaging preservation flux imaging solution that's been out for 3-4 years. Now, what the system consists of is the Applesauce device, which is a small box that you plug your disk drive into, and a client software that runs only on Mac OS. Sorry, PC, Windows, everybody. But basically, this is a project that has been in development intensely for these last 4 years, and I've been working with it and done a ton of imaging and preservation using it. And I love the whole system. And, you know, the developer is John Morris, and he's usually very open to bugs and necessary improvements. He has a real vision, and he's an incredibly capable engineer. So this device is getting both a software and a hardware, I would say a software upgrade and a hardware new version. You can still use your original Applesauce as you've been using it, and there's no reason not to. If you decide you want to image using PC drives to image your PC software, or there's a good number of other formats that a PC drive will image, then the new iteration of the hardware is for you. I've just been trying it out, And with a little work, I got one of my 1.2 megabyte 5 1/4 inch floppy drives working. And I would say with a little work, certainly, and a lot of help. And it's pretty amazing if you have these drives. I think there's other, you know, disk imaging and fluxing and preservation solutions. But this one, certainly if you've ever tried the client, and you're free to download the client just to play with it, even if you can't, if you don't have the hardware. And you can download Flux images and other images, WAS images, or, I mean, I should play with it, but I'm not sure if you can just load up an image file from any other format, and it will do its analysis. For an unprotected images, it can parse, you know, DOS, Apple, Atari DOS catalogs and files. It's pretty impressive what it can do. But if you decide you want to preserve your old disks, this is a great solution that's very easy to use. We've discussed it many, many times on the podcast before, but I was just bringing to everybody's attention that with the new client, although there has been some support of, you know, of Commodore 64, Atari 8-bit, and single-sided PC, now this goes whole hog into, you know, double-sided imaging on 5 1/4. The even the old client supported 3.5 inch imaging of just about anything if you had a an Apple SuperDrive hooked up, but this also opens the door to using PC 3.5 inch drives with your AppleSauce device. It adds an extra connector and takes that 4-pin power, the connector that goes to PC drives and the cables. So it's kind of a ready-made solution if you can get one, and what is it? I think it's 34 pins, and it goes to a card edge connector on your PC drive, and then it takes power out of the AppleSauce as well by having a 20-pin to the 4-pin power on your disk. It's simple. Hmm. If it required cable construction, I couldn't do it. I cannot build a cable for the life of me, at least not without many, many hours to spare. So it's a pretty ready-made solution if you decide you want to go there. As far as what you can image with a PC drive, well, anything, most of the formats that are unprotected, it can image. But once you get to protection schemes on things like an Apple II, you'll still want a disk II, which is what the most basic, form of the hardware comes with. It comes with, you know, the ability to image using a disk II disk drive, which was the standard original Apple II drive, and it also happens to have a very flexible flexible design that allows it to do other basic imaging. I think if you should realize if you wanted to do anything with 40 tracks, you're going to need either a third-party Apple II drive, or you'll have to move to the PC drive. So the client now, I mean, the list of formats that it supports, at least unprotected, includes Amiga, Atari ST, IBM PC, 360K, and, you know, 1.2 megabyte, as well as the 3.5 inch drives for PC. It supports Mac, 2GS, Apple 2GS. It supports even some exotic disks that weren't that popular. The TI-99, it'll support 5 1/4 inch CPM. You can probably hook up your 8-inch drive to it. But this is a major, you know, step up for compatibility with a wide variety of drives and formats for the AppleSauce imaging system. And again, the client just keeps marching forward with John's intense programming efforts. So I highly recommend at least checking out the client and seeing how easy it truly is to use. You want to hook up a PC drive? It's probably going to be some jumper setting adjustments. But it's certainly not too difficult.
Yeah, you know, I've been impressed with this software from the outset, you know, and it's really nice to be able to sort of like do all of this in one package. I have a few of the, you know, the other sort of PC drive things, and I haven't played with much apart from the what was it called, CryoFlux, which didn't have particularly amazing software and has sort of, it's, there's some, issues with the the sort of organization that puts that together. I mean, that they have not been very open with their format, and it had been reverse engineered, I think, by Keir Fraser, maybe. But at any rate, I haven't had much experience with the other imagers. But I'm the fact that the Applesauce is now able to connect to PC drives is great. There are a few things that I have that I would like to image that way. And anything that needs to be able to sort of synchronize both sides of a disk really kind of needs a drive like that. I think I have the next thing, and I'll maybe just quickly mention this, that we started recording up against Scott Adams at VCF East. So we're sorry about that. But VCF East is just sort of finishing now. This is the third of 3 days, I think. And it's happening in person, although they do have a stream going as well. So if you, when you're done with this, or if you didn't realize, you can quickly jump off and we can watch as our viewer numbers go down. But anyway, definitely take a look at that. There was Ted Nelson gave a talk earlier today. On Friday, there was a Programming the FujiNet class. David Aul gave an incomplete history of computer games as well. Bill Mensch of WDC, and there's various other things on the schedule. It looks interesting, and I have watched none of it so far, but I'm looking forward to checking it out at least. Have either of you watched any of it?
I caught bits and pieces of some of the streams. Mm-hmm. I saw Michael Tomsik's talk on early days at Commodore, some of Bill Hurd's talk, and a couple other things, but didn't have time to watch the whole thing. But it was neat that they were streaming it. It was kind of cool to see some of it live.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what did you say, Paul? I was watching the VCF East stream.
Okay, let's see. So I guess maybe we can leave it at that and go to a word from our sponsor.
It's Big Track, the computer-activated tracker and the automatic transporter. Your child sends Big Track off on a mission by programming in up to 16 commands. Like fire 3 laser blasts. Big Track stores your child's commands. To get out of a tricky spot. To complete the mission, Big Track rolls in, drops the payload, then heads for home base in another assignment. Big Track for your child from NB Electronics, transporter sold separately.
Where is Newton? Newton's in small towns and hamlets. Newton's in the urban jungle. Newton can get you from the urban jungle to the nearest hamlet. Newton goes wherever people need to communicate. Newton can send a letter or a memo. Newton can be reached via satellite. Newton faxes from places where there's no fax machine.
Yo, you got a fax machine?
Newton is everywhere. Well, that's not a bad place to be.
Where's Newton in relation to what? The universe or Des Moines?
And we're back. So the host's retro computing gift idea this time is Commodore 64 socks, because the weather's starting to get chilly and you're going to need socks. So I don't know, Earl, did you want to say anything about this? You were the one, I think, who located this.
I didn't have much to say about it other than that I think you need it. And it was a rebuttal to something that Carrington had done on our on our private chat. And so I decided that we definitely need Commodore socks represented here. I'll probably buy some for myself. I might even buy some for my daughter because she likes quirky socks of different kinds. So
let's see if there are Sam Coupe socks.
Check back tomorrow. I'll take care of them.
Okay. Excellent. Okay. Well, yeah. So these are not expensive, $16.15, or $14.53 when you buy two or more. I don't know. Why would you want one sock? Perhaps they are sold in pairs.
I think more than one pair.
Okay.
Anyway, Commodore socks. They're not priced exorbitantly. They're socks for the masses, not the classes.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so you should have plenty of money left over after buying your Commodore socks. And with that, you can go to eBay, and Earl has the first eBay item.
I just thought that this Franklin computer looked cool. Have we talked about this model before, the ACE 500?
I don't think so.
This is a cool-looking computer. Let me describe it, if I can. It's a, would you call that, it's a shade of gray, and it has a grill on the top. It's rather square in its appearance. The keys are also a combination of black and gray with some red accents toward the top. I was familiar with a couple of Franklin models, but I don't think I'd ever seen this one before. And part of the reason that I like the eBay auction is because I think listeners know this at this point. I like auctions for computers that are verified as working. And they actually show the boot up screen of this Franklin computer on one of the screenshots in the auction. Not sure about the price. Apple folks or Apple compatible folks might be better to comment on whether a $350 buy it now is appropriate for this particular system. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, I think that these are relatively rare. So if you are the sort of person who is interested in this kind of clone, it might be hard to find one otherwise, but I don't know. It's probably right at the edge. It looks really nice. I do like it, and I don't feel like I've seen it before, so.
This is a handsome clone. I think that clones in general demand less in the Apple II world because they are called a peach, and they look just like an Apple II Plus with, you know, poor paint or something. But this is a nice-looking computer. I think it is feasible to ask $350 for it. Do I know? I don't know that it will sell at this price, but it may. I think that at $200, it'd be more likely to sell, and at $150, it would almost certainly sell, and I might buy it. But, you know, this is a really nice-looking clone. So I think it will definitely push the window. It certainly is not an insane price.
Yeah.
I have a soft spot in my heart for Franklin. That last computer store that I talked about where I worked at, we weren't an Apple dealer, and we would have liked to have been, but Apple was very selective and didn't want to have too many dealers in one region, you know, a lot of things. So people would walk in and ask us if we had Apple, and when we said no, sometimes they'd just turn around and walk right out of the store without any kind of further ado. So for a while, we did have Franklin, and that kind of saved us in that we could say we don't have Apple, but we do have a computer that costs less and runs all the software, and we can show you that. And sometimes that would save us, and other times they'd still turn around and walk out. Just depended. But anyway, Franklin was pretty cool. And we had the early Franklin, the one that I think almost got sued into oblivion because the way that they'd gone about compatibility. This looks like a later model after they'd already probably resolved all that.
I had a friend, in fact, that very same friend who would beat me at Descent, who had some other version of Franklin. I don't know the model numbers as well, but it was sort of a off-white color, and I think it was the one that had the disk drives built into it under a kind of like a hood. To that extent, I have a sort of a friendly memory of Franklin as well, just because it was, you know, it was the computer that he had. Yeah, I don't feel completely up on the story of being sued into oblivion, but
well, I think they reached an agreement, but for more on the history, you'd have to go read up on it. I think I don't know much more than that, other than just They kind of got in trouble for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, I seem to remember that one of the people who was sort of like, you know, in charge of the company or something was a keynote for VCF East maybe sometime not too long ago. Some within the last few years, VCF meeting, I think. All right. Anyway, okay. Ian, you have the next thing.
Yeah, I found these computer flash cards, and really I was hoping for some Carrington style input, but alas, he's absent. This inexpensive set of they look new computer flash cards. This is sort of like a kid's flash card by the publisher Golden, and it's called Scooter Computer and Mr. Chips Introductory Computer Language Flash Cards. And there are 3x5 flash cards. And the artwork is this like comic style that reminds me of Schoolhouse Rock, where there's a kid on a skateboard, not a very large skateboard, pouring numbers into a computer via a funnel. I don't know. It's good stuff.
The computer looks very happy about it.
And why wouldn't he be? But it's also inexpensive and a bit of fun. Probably look nice on your shelf.
I found another auction that has a couple more photos of this too. So if you wanted to sort of see like what the cards were like. On one side it says a computer language used mostly by scientists and mathematicians. And if you
Fortran.
Flip it over, it is Fortran, yes. Earl gets the point.
Wow.
I wonder about these, you know, like they don't seem to have a lot of replayability to me. You know, it's kind of an interesting novelty. I wonder if any kids actually derived any benefit out of these.
I think this is one that they had to be bribed.
Yeah.
To play.
Eat your vegetables and you don't have to play Scooter Computer and Mr. Chips. Excellent.
And then the next item, I found this Microsoft Premium Soft Card. And the auction says it's the PAL version. So the Microsoft Soft Card was the first coprocessor, or at least Z80 coprocessor, for the Apple II line. And Microsoft went ahead and made an improvement as soon as the Apple IIe came out. I think the soft card came out in 1980 and immediately was cloned. And there were probably dozens of other versions of it sold. But this is the Apple IIe improved version, which fits in the auxiliary slot, because the Apple IIe had an extra slot for your 80 column card and 64 additional K. It was doubling the RAM and doubling the width of your screen. And it wasn't as though the Apple II didn't have the capability of being 80 columns before then. But there were other cards that did that I don't understand for your Apple II Plus. This one, though, first off, I love the premium soft card, despite the fact that I've had two and I could never figure out how to get it to work. The it's a proprietary software situation compared to the original soft card. It requires the Microsoft CPM premium soft card version. And it might just be that the images that I had on the internet didn't work, or I didn't have the right voodoo. And the card, as you can see, if you can see the auction, the card is very long. These premium soft cards are very long, and they barely fit in an Apple IIe. You kind of have to put it in nose first under the keyboard and then get it to settle in. It's gigantic. And this one I thought was even more fascinating because it has this dead space at the end of the card. I'm sure the back of the PCB has something on it, but there's not much.
No,
it just has this empty space in the nose at the tip of the card that would fit under the keyboard. I don't remember seeing that on the soft cards that I've had, although I probably should do a quick comparison. But if this really is a PAL version, I just think it's a neat novelty. And it probably not that many of them made. I mean, I would imagine less than 10,000. So so an interesting variation on a really cool Apple IIe peripheral card.
That's interesting. So it says attention, this is a Z80 premium for the Apple IIe. PAL won't fit in the NTSC Apple IIe. The aux port should be aligned with slot 3. And that's true, actually, now that this is mentioned in the description there. I do remember that the aux card does it's like the slot is in different places in the NTSC and the PAL ones, and that's presumably why that this is it's a PAL version, not because it actually has to interact with the video, but because physically it has to fit in the machine.
That was confusing me. Thank you for clearing that up. I was kind of wondering why the coprocessor would care about the video standard, but that makes sense if the machines are physically different.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then the other item I have is this Gravis gamepad for Macintosh. And this was a gamepad that sort of mimicked, you know, what Nintendo was doing. And I had one of these for my PC, and I quite liked it. I think the auction is a little misleading. It says for Macintosh or 2GS. I've only seen driver discs for Mac. I'm not sure how this would work with a 2GS. The 2GS does have a joystick, the standard 9-pin joystick port. So I wonder if anything would take advantage of this automatically in a 2GS if it was plugged into the ADB port. I kind of doubt it, though. I think Macintosh and the unfortunate driver discs are what you need. What's neat about this one, well, it's funny because I saw this one pop up and it was priced at $12 as an actual auction. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, for $12, I could play with it. You know, it's not, that's not, you know, a huge take. But then it disappeared and reappeared as a $35 buy it now, which seems to be sort of the market rate, but it's more than I wanted to invest because I probably won't play a ton of games on a Macintosh with this thing. But it's funny because these some of these gamepads, like this one, have a screw-on joystick. It doesn't seem very ergonomic to use, or more ergonomic than a thumb pad, but that tends to get lost easily, and it's kind of nice that it's included.
Is it broken off? It kind of looks to me like it's actually broken. Like it may be screwed in, like it was screwed in and then snapped off.
You may be right.
I think I've heard of the Gravis gamepad, but I don't think I'd ever seen one before now.
Yeah, I liked it quite a lot when I was PC gaming in the late 80s and 90s. I thought it was a great controller. And also the Gravis name, Gravis Wico, you know, I was probably carrying on further than I needed to in thinking that they were really high quality companies. I know Wico sort of had this deterioration of its quality. Wico was a controller manufacturer and arcade control manufacturer. And Gravis made some solid joysticks for the time. That's another thing I used for analog input was the Gravis, I don't remember what it was called, the Gravis joystick, though. It was a black joystick with red accents.
I have one that is not that color. It was more sort of beige, sitting just out of reach here, but I can't quite remember what it was called.
That's the ADB Macintosh mouse stick version, I believe.
Maybe, yeah.
Or, yeah.
I think you might be right, actually. It pretends it's a mouse. And John in the chat says the screw in the joystick is broken in that one. That, by the way, that is the same John in the chat that is that has brought us applesauce also. So hello, John.
Oh, that guy.
cool. Okay, let's see. So I have, as usual, I found too many things. So I will, let's see, talk about some of them. Which ones shall I talk about? This one I thought was kind of interesting. Oh, it's expensive. It is the 1985 Axlon Andy. I kind of think we talked about this once before, actually, that it's come up before. It's this, it's like a little robot. It kind of looks like a shoe. but it's a little, I think it connects maybe to an Atari. Axlon Andy vintage robot for Atari 800 with the original box and guide. That's got to be unusual. Do you guys have any experience with this? Have either of you seen one in action or anything?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I have one of these Nolan Bushnell robots, but I can't remember which, and I believe that they did sell interfaces for multiple computers. I think there probably is an Apple II interface for this thing as well, but the fact is I've never seen it in action. And wow, it has that awesome front wheel that looks like it was taken right off of a rolling couch or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it's no expense was spared.
Yeah, this is just another one of those famed companies that came out of this kind of proto incubator that Nolan Bushnell got involved in as soon as he left Atari. He had a number of different companies, including Chuck E. Cheese. And I think that that these never met with the success that they'd hoped. It was, you know, bringing robots home, and I don't think we've done that yet, really, without terrifying cats everywhere.
Yeah. Well, and it's unclear, like, what function this could possibly serve, you know, in any sort of functional way. It's just kind of funny to watch it roll around, basically.
I mean, I wonder if it you know, if it had a great deal more functionality and programmability than a big track. Do you guys remember the big track?
I remember the ads for that. I think I maybe had a friend who had one. Did you have one?
I should have one in storage with the trailer. But the one that I never had one as a kid. But it was one of those things I probably thought was part of my electronic games collection and had to have when I found it, you know, at a resale shop or something. But I did play with the modern version. They do sell a Big Track Mini, which is kind of fun to program. I tried to get my kids to play with it, but I think it was more exciting to me at the time than it was to them.
Well, that was, I guess, so that would be a sort of a little programming project, right? You say, like, you know, go forward, turn right, go forward, turn left. And, you know, if you're lucky, it will not fall down the stairs.
I had the same experience with the Lego robotic invention system, the Lego RIS that I got it. And I thought, yeah, this is for the kids. Yeah.
And the kids were not interested.
Well, my son was for a while, but then kind of moved on. But, yeah, Dad kept playing with it.
Yeah, Dad said it was for you. but in fact.
Dads love toys, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That's right. What should I talk about next? I mean, I guess in keeping with the networking theme, one thing that I thought was just something was this vintage 1994 Apple Newton fax modem for the message pad. So if you want to be if you want to just go all in on your obsolescence, here you go. It's a fax modem for the Newton. I think it'd be interesting to, you know, try it at some point. I don't know. It's not expensive, but it is probably the kind of thing that you would get 7 minutes of interest out of, and then, you know, you'd connect with something, it would work, and that would be the last you'd see of it.
I've always kind of wished someone would create like a mini kind of PBX that I could plug the cable that plugged into a telephone. Does anybody remember what the name of it was?
Well, it would have been RJ something, right?
RJ, yeah.
45, or 11.
I think it's RJ 11.
RJ 11
phone lines.
And I always wanted someone to create something I could plug all my modems into it that would do all the networking for me so that I could, back to the topic of networking, so that I could connect these computers using regular old modems at 300 baud. I think that would be, that'd be fun, where you didn't have to modify the computer with a, you know, a lot of fancy hardware to get it to, you know, reach the network. And not only that, I want to hear dial tones, and I want to hear ringtones. I want to hear ringing tones, not ringtone. We have ringtones on our phone.
Yeah.
But and then, you know, for this, well, you could try to send a fax to another computer. You could send this to a WinFax modem on your late 80s PC.
Yeah.
I think the challenge is the hardware that simulates an old POTS, plain old telephone system. Line with the voltages and the ring equivalents and all that. You can find them. You can buy one on eBay, and then if you've got an old PC hanging around, you could pop it in there and run open source PBX software like Asterix or things of that nature. So most of it you could do for free. It's just getting the interface card that acts like an old phone jack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some time ago, I mean, years ago, I got a device that was supposed to be, you know, it was basically supposed to be a home internal PBX. So, you know, you could, I mean, I'm not sure what the actual use case was, but it was supposed to be for a home and not a business. But you basically, you know, you could have different extensions throughout your house. And so I have yet to set that up, but I have always had that exact, you know, that exact hope for it, that I could at least, you know, I could set up two computers, two Apple IIs with Apple Cats in each, and then transfer, you know, some piece of software across the room. I could chat to myself when
Cat
Burr is running.
I've got a couple of old U.S. Robotics externals, and if I wanted to get even crazier, I'd have to get a handset for this, but I've got a couple of acoustic couplers also, if I could get those running. So it would be fun to hear the old sounds.
Yeah, I have, the Apple Cat 2 that we had talked about before was this modem that would do 300 baud full duplex and 1200 half. So that was a big thing for a while 1200 baud modems were expensive. But it was a pretty sophisticated card, and it had two plugs on it. One was for the actual thing that you connected to the wall, and then the other one was for the receiver, so that you could actually they had these funny little I'll find a picture of it, but the funny little cradles that you could put to the on the hang on the side of your Apple II, and you could hang the receiver off of it. And nobody I know actually still has those. Let's see, just James Littlejohn actually printed some new ones. 3D. I'm not sure if he 3D printed them or if he just fabricated them in some way. I'm opening the thing now. They're these little hooks that you put on the, in the vents of your Apple II, and then the receiver would just the phone would just sit on it as if it was hanging on a cradle. But so anyway, what made me think about this is that the receiver has the phone, plug has a slightly smaller plug, and I'm not quite sure what it is. If RJ11 is the one that goes to the wall, something that is a little bit smaller than that is the thing that goes to the receiver. I think this is probably AT&T right. Princess phones.
It's like RJ9
to the handset.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
that
I want to
slightly smaller and also a standard.
Yeah. So I definitely want to get one of those specifically for the AppleCat, so I can use the little thing and put the receiver next to it. There is a funny picture in some of their ads for that that shows that. But I probably had, it's conceivable that I had these little pieces originally, but who knows where? I mean, I've never seen one except for this reproduction. In real life, I don't think, unless I saw it when I was a kid and forgot.
I believe I have a set, but I really am an AppleCat and Novation kind of fan. Well, I mean, at least the vintage Novation stuff. So, yeah, the originals were kind of this brown smoked plastic, and it's great because they would hang in the – wouldn't they hang in the vent holes of your case? So it's cute. There were a lot of AppleCat accessories. That was – that modem had – multiple capabilities. It had tone generation. It could act as an answering machine. Of course, I don't know how long it could digitally. Nice. It could digitally record. But it was a crazy. The system had a bunch of expansion capabilities in addition to the 212 card that you would have to buy. That was just as big as the original modem to make it 1200 baud full duplex.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like a card, but it didn't actually sit in a slot. You could put it in a slot if you wanted to, but most people I think just put it sort of on top of their power supply. It was
the 212.
Sort of, yeah.
Well, there were two options to plugging in the 212 expansion card for the AppleCat. One was you'd plug it into a slot that would power it, and then you would connect it to the original device. But it also came with a power supply interceptor cable. That you would unplug your power supply from the motherboard, the Apple IIe motherboard, and then you would plug it into this device and then this cable, and then you would plug that into the motherboard, and then the cable also had an output that would power the 212 modem expansion.
Another thing that was super cool about this was you can sort of see this in this picture here that I'm showing is there's a unit on the back, so you could get this sort of auxiliary thing that would give you a serial output, I think so an RS-232 port, but it would also give you access to this X10 system, so you could turn your lights on and off with your modem.
Oh wow.
So if you got the touch-tone decoder, you could basically call it up, type in I would like my living room light to be off, and then it would turn your living room light off. It's pretty excellent. So I have one of these finally, a few years ago, I located it, but, and it, the one time I tried it, I couldn't get it to work, but it might be just because, X10 is difficult to make work anyway. But, so at some point I definitely want to go back and try that. Also, if you watch, National Lampoon's Vacation, you can see that whoever provided the Apple II for that movie had one of these boxes on the back of their Apple II. So, yeah. Anyway, that was something of a digression from the eBay auctions, but it's possible that's as interesting as any of the eBay auctions. Anyway, maybe this is interesting. I'll mention one more thing, which is the Farallon IR AirDock. Again, the connectivity theme. So this is a instant infrared connection for your PowerBook. And I don't know how long infrared lasted as a thing. I don't think it lasted very long, but one of the first iMacs, like the gumdrop iMacs, had an IR port in the front, I think. And I think even some of the beige ones did. Do you guys have any experience with IR communications?
I have no good experience with IR communications. I think this reminds me, did the RCR discuss the Cybico, that Cybico device, which is like this crazy communicator device? I think that had some IR capabilities, and it would just cause you to throw your hands up in the air and plug it into a serial port and worry about IRQs. It was torture. All I remember is, don't stand in front of me when I'm changing the channel.
Right.
PDAs, I think, mm-hmm. had a better run with infrared than computers. Trying to connect up PDAs with the computer over infrared was the bang your head against the wall experience that Ian was just describing. I always found it to be extremely troublesome, and I just wind up getting the dock and hooking to a serial port also. Right. So frustrating. Great idea, but...
I do remember one time... I mean, like, I almost never used IR, but one time I was, like, really late for something, and there was a sort of department shared printer, and it had an IR port, and I had the thing I needed to print on my like Trio or something. And just because, you know, I didn't really have time to run up to my office and print the thing, I just like ran into the print room, pointed the device at the printer, and it worked. And I was astounded. I was able to just sort of like print the thing I needed off my, you know, Trio, and then run to where I had to go. So I have a fondness for IR based on that. But I mean, like, other than that, I do know that a bunch of my sort of like palm type of devices could talk to each other with that, but I almost never even attempted to try to use any of that. That's another project. I have too many projects. Someday I will try that project.
One project at a time.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
The IRL project seems to be the one that always takes up all the time, that whole in real life.
Right. Not the infrared project. L. okay. I think I will leave it at that, just because, you know, it's been many hours by now. So we can maybe move on to closing discussions. Earl, did you have any closing notes?
No parting shots today.
All right. That was quick. Ian, any from you?
Well, I can only say one project at a time. You just got to, you know, be happy if you can get through one project, or even start one project and set it aside and move on to the next. I guess that's two projects at a time. Sometimes it's actually more. But I'm always happy to get any of these projects done. I would say even more happy when it's a project related to a TRS-80, because they seem to be a real pain in the rear.
I see. So you like working on those because succeeding is a real accomplishment.
You might phrase it that way.
Yeah.
The thrill of victory.
Yeah, I guess I've been spending a fair amount of time setting up, you know, my environment here. I've you know, trying to set up all these various machines, generally Apple machines, but you know, just trying to make sure they still work and stuff like that. And I've actually, you know, I do kind of, there's a sense in which some of the stuff just works, you know, and it may not be that much of an accomplishment. You know, like once I get the AppleTalk server working, you know, everything can communicate with each other. You know, I all I have to do is turn it on and make sure that the wires are plugged in. And when it's not working, it's because I plugged, you know, like the wrong things into each other or whatever. So, but yeah, it's, I'm definitely having fun, you know, sort of setting this up. Although, I mean, there's just a lot of wires to route. Okay. Anyway, yeah, it feels like sort of an abrupt end, but at the same time, it has been a long recording. So thanks everybody for joining us in the chat. Thank you for podcasting. And that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show on the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at @rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. If you are not a robot, please answer the questions. If you do not answer the questions, we will assume you are a robot. Send feedback to, did I say that already? No, I did not. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. You could write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time,
Retro Compute.